welcome to Diabetes Health Alternatives, the weekly online radio show for people living and thriving with diabetes. I'm your host, Bradley Capture. As a type 2 diabetic myself, I've spent years educating people on how to manage type 2 diabetes with little or no medication using my method of yoga for diabetes. This show is an extension of that experience. Diabetes Health Alternatives is a resource for diabetics and the people in their lives to talk about diabetes management, alternative treatments, and useful resources. Every week I'll speak with experts, educators, and alternative therapists about the latest and greatest developments in diabetes care. Please remember, Diabetes Health Alternatives is not a substitute for advice from your healthcare provider, but a forum for diabetes discussion and debate.
Become a fan of Diabetes Health Alternatives. Go to Diabetes Health Alternatives on Facebook.
So this week, we turn our attention to two words that are never far from a diabetic's lips, and that's diet and nutrition. Of course, there are many options on how to deal with diet and nutrition. And today, Elizabeth DeRobertis is on the show. She's a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator. Thank you for joining us today, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
Good. My pleasure. So I myself am a diabetic, so of course I know that diet is a key factor. Could you break it down for us a little bit and explain why food is key in the life of a diabetic?
Well, the carbohydrates that we eat all turn into glucose in our body. And what happens when someone has diabetes is that either their body is not producing enough insulin, their pancreas is not releasing enough insulin, or the insulin is there, but their cells are not sensitive enough to that insulin. So regardless of the reason, what the result is that their body feels overwhelmed by breaking down too many carbohydrates in one sitting. And so the management of food and of carbohydrates specifically is, you know, has a major impact on overall blood sugar control.
So let me ask you this. You know, in my experience working with people, it's easier, I should say easier, not easy, for me to get people to exercise. I teach meditation as well and breathing technique induction. And people will oftentimes tend to do something like that at first because they think it's sort of fun and different. But, you know, I have found, you know, personally, and your caveat on this, that diet is the hardest thing to get across to people that they have to change in their life. I mean, and what kind of tools do you use to get that across to people?
I think that that's a really good point. And I think that what I see is that a lot of people, they're just not sure what to do. And they think that what they need to do is going to be overly restrictive and that they will never be able to look at food in the same way again. So they figure that if they can't do it all, that they might as well do nothing. And what I actually do in my practice is really help people to see how their food choices have an immediate impact on their blood sugar. So I focus very much on testing blood sugar 2 hours after meals to help someone to figure out which of their meals result in a good blood sugar and which meals result in a higher blood sugar. And if someone is dedicated to doing that and they can test 2 hours after their meals, they're able to see right away the immediate feedback of a good choice and a choice that's not so great. And then that helps them to see where they need to make modifications. So I think that I really hardly use the word diet because I think that diets don't work. And I think that especially for diabetes, that it's definitely not one size fits all. Each person has a different tolerance in terms of how many carbohydrates they can take in at each meal. So if someone puts in a little bit of work up front by looking at what they eat, testing their blood sugar after, figuring out what works, what doesn't work, then it's really a matter of just putting this balancing act into their lifestyle instead of thinking that they can never eat sugar again. Because the whole idea of looking at sugar for someone with diabetes is like a big misconception and really puts a lot of people in the wrong direction.
So basically you have them keep a very specific food log. Do you have them log the types of foods, portions, and then do the glucose check a couple hours?
Exactly. And so we do the what they eat, how many grams of carbohydrate, and then their blood sugar 2 hours later. And it's interesting when you say types of food, one of the first things that we talk about is that when you have diabetes and you're worried about your blood sugar, so many people just think of the sugar in food. So they look at food labels and they look at sugar, whereas you really need to be looking at total carbohydrates and not even look at sugar because all of the carbs turn to sugar in our bodies. And when someone looks at just sugar, very often they're accidentally choosing much higher carbohydrate foods. Another thing that's really important is the spacing of carbohydrates during the day. So even if it's all a healthy form of carbohydrate, let's say it's a high-fiber cereal with fat-free milk and some fruit on top. That all has carbohydrates, and it may be too much for one person to have the cereal, the milk, and the fruit all at the same time. And so if they saved that piece of fruit and they had it a couple of hours later, just by spacing out their carbohydrates, their blood sugar would be immediately much better. So we do look at what they eat, the spacing of their food, how many grams of carbohydrate, and then the resulting blood glucose.
Now, as far as spacing, let me ask you this. As far as your take on diet, do you tend to work with your clients more on smaller meals and snacks? Or do you work on that as an individual basis as well, as far as how they respond to things?
It often does end up working out in that way, that someone ends up eating a little bit of a smaller meal, so then more often during the day, because the worst thing for blood sugar control is to go too long without eating, to end up being starving, and then overeat, because it's that, the overeating that would then really cause a spike in blood sugar. So for a lot of people, they have breakfast, they may have a small morning snack, they have lunch, and then very often someone may have one, two, or even three small snacks spaced out during the afternoon to prevent overeating at dinner. And if someone needs to reduce their carbohydrates at their meal to keep their blood sugar down, they may find that they're hungrier sooner, and so it almost creates the need for smaller, more frequent meals.
Now, you mentioned overeating, and oftentimes, maybe you can elaborate on this, I know that oftentimes people think of that just as overeating, say, the wrong kind of foods. But in essence, because of the way that the digestive system reacts, you can also perhaps even overeat the right kind of foods, and it creates a response in the belly due to the overfilling, like, say, a head of lettuce. Some people eat these salads like the lettuce salad, and they think, well, that's fine, I've got it covered. But doesn't that also causes the body to produce more glucose? Is that correct?
Not really. The one thing that I always say, that I never worked with someone that either created high blood sugar or that didn't lose weight because they ate too many vegetables. So that is actually something that I do feel like is a freebie. What I do see happening is that someone will say, I'm trying not to eat cookies, so now I'm eating fruit. And I'm trying, not to have too many snacks, so now I'm having yogurt. And that they could accumulate too much of a good thing from healthy foods like yogurt and fruit and other sources that have carbohydrate. But the one thing that I do feel like is really a free food are vegetables. If someone was going to snack on celery and cucumbers and even baby carrots and cut-up peppers and fennel, that's my new favorite snack, that someone could eat vegetables all day long, it would not raise their blood sugar, and it would help them to prevent overeating because then they would never get so hungry.
Can I get that little recipe again with the fennel? I love fennel, so I want to jot down what you just said there.
Do you know what I do with the fennel? I mean, so each one of those things, I just eat them raw. I have cut up bell peppers all the time, but fennel is something that a lot of people cook with but don't think of eating it raw.
Yeah.
I had it on a veggie platter one day, and I was like, wow, this is great. What is it? And when I found it was fennel, it became my new favorite raw vegetable snack. The entire bulb of fennel has only 78 calories and very few carbs. If any, and you can just cut up the fennel raw and snack on it, and instead of it leaving you with a sweet taste or a salty taste, leaving you maybe wanting more snacks, it leaves you with such a nice, fresh, refreshing taste in your mouth after that I find it's an excellent snack food.
Oh, well, that's great. You know what? I've always cooked with it as well. I've never had it raw. I'll have to give that a stab. So while we're on, let's go. Can you give us some more good food choices for diabetics now that we're on food?
So lean protein is really good and important, and lean protein would be things like chicken and turkey. Of course, the skin should be off of the chicken. So chicken, turkey, fish, any type of fish is really great. Pork, like if it was a pork chop or a pork tenderloin, or very lean ground beef. And the reason why the protein should definitely be lean is that if someone has diabetes, that they're also at a higher risk of heart disease. So that even if a steak doesn't raise your blood sugar, it still should not be considered a free food, because of the risk of heart disease and because of the saturated fat in the steak. And so sometimes when someone's trying to control their blood sugar, they may go on an Atkins type of diet where they cut out the carbohydrates and they eat a lot more protein and fat, and that is definitely not the right plan for someone that has diabetes because they have to be especially careful of their heart health.
Okay, let me ask you this. What about in this picture, what do you recommend and how do you work with vegetarians as far as getting, an ample amount of protein and not too many carbs?
It's interesting. That's a good question, and it is tough. That's probably one of the toughest things to do because for a vegetarian, a lot of their protein sources have carbohydrates in them too. So someone, you should not need to be on such a low carbohydrate diet to keep your blood sugar in good control. So that person may need to do some more spacing during the day. You should always be able to accumulate at least, let's say, 120 grams of carbs throughout the day. If someone needs to be so restrictive that they cannot have some carbohydrate at each meal without their blood sugar going up, then it may be an issue where they need some more or some different medication to help to keep their blood sugar down. Because if a vegetarian may choose beans as a protein source, which also have carbohydrates, but they also have protein and fiber and are really healthy. And most vegetarian protein sources are going to have some carbohydrates. So the spacing would be really important, and to also complement those foods with other vegetables that are very low in carbohydrates.
While we're talking about carbs there and fiber, can you give us sort of the formula, how to balance off your carbohydrate or how to rate your carbohydrate intake in relation to the fiber that's also in the food?
So one of like a textbook rule of thumb is that if something has more than 5 grams of fiber in it, you can deduct the fiber from the total carbs. But I think that sometimes that misleads people. And for a while, there was on food labels, it would say net carbs or impact carbs, and they were deducting the fiber and the sugar alcohols, claiming that it had no impact on your blood sugar. And if you've noticed, that's not really on labels anymore because it's really not true. It still could impact your blood sugar. So I find that sometimes when someone is just looking for high fiber, they end up still with too many carbs. So what I usually say to do is look at the carbohydrates primary, you know, as the primary choice. And then if there's two products that have a similar amount of carbohydrate and one of them has more of those carbs coming from fiber, to absolutely choose that one. So in the day, we want to try to get 25 to 35 grams of fiber at least during the day. But you may not get the fiber, let's say, a very high fiber bread may also have a ton of carbs in it. You may be better off getting more fiber from fruits and vegetables and a lower carb bread that still has fiber in it, but again, spaced out during the day.
Right. Now, so you mentioned sugar alcohols. I know with me, it varies a little bit. You know, usually not that successful. They still tend to affect my blood sugars. What's your experience on that?
I think that they do still impact blood sugar. They say that if 1 gram of carbohydrate had, you know, the way that, actually I was going to say it wrong, I was going to say calorie-wise, like 1 gram of carbohydrate is considered to have 4 calories, and what they say with sugar alcohols is that you may consider it to have about 2 calories, meaning that your body may not fully break down the sugar alcohol, but it still does to some extent. My best experience with this is working with my patients that have type 1 diabetes, so that they're dosing their insulin based on an exact number of carbs. What I see that is that for some people, if a product is very high in fiber, very high in sugar alcohols, then in that situation where they're dosing their insulin, that they do need to deduct maybe about half of the fiber and sugar alcohols from the product. But other people, and especially in the case of type 2 diabetes, I don't have anyone subtract anything. I think it's better to assume that it's all going to impact your blood sugar. And the reason is that we also all always eat a little bit more than we think anyway. So by deducting those things, it's giving us a false, sense of the total carbs, and keeping them in gives us a little bumper to work with.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have a pretty warped view of a 4-ounce portion. My 4-ounce portion is pretty big, so I agree with you there. Okay, so how about foods that the diabetic should definitely steer clear of?
The one thing that I like to usually say that there's nothing that you need to totally ever avoid, except for the one thing is juice and soda. So juice or soda, any kind of like really refined concentrated carbohydrate, that's the treatment for low blood sugar. So you know that if you're low and you drink 4 ounces of juice, which is 15 carbs, it shoots your blood sugar right back up. And so thinking of it in that way means that in the course of a regular day, if someone that has diabetes is drinking any regular juice or regular soda, that it's going to keep spiking their blood sugar up. So that's one of the things that I would say to really try to never do. Other than that, other things that I look for are very dense carbohydrate foods, such as like a bagel. A bagel may have about 80 carbs in it. So if someone switched from a bagel to an English muffin, they're saving so many carbs just by making that one swap. Another thing that I think about is that not to accumulate so many carbs in one meal, so to use certain tactics so that this is a situation that you would want to not get into. If you went out to dinner, you would not want to sit down and have bread first and then have a salad that had croutons on it, and then to order pasta as an entree, possibly with more bread on the side, and then have dessert, because that's just, you know, carbs are all over that meal. But instead to do something maybe like have a salad first and then have a protein and two vegetables as your entree, saving a little bit of carbs for dessert, or if you weren't going to have dessert, have a carb side dish, but basically to choose one carbohydrate to have somewhere in your meal, but not to choose meals that have carbohydrates in the starters, the entrees, and the dessert.
And we'll hear from Elizabeth later.
You're listening to Diabetes Health Alternatives with Bradley Capture.
Continuing on the theme of diet nutrition, we have to remember there is an emotional component to what we eat and why we eat. Aaron Snyder was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes at the age of 22. He's the author of The New Diabetes Prescription.
Well, it was pretty obvious that it was the way I was eating and the lack of exercising that caused me to have diabetes at such an early age. To back up a bit, I do come from a very strong line of diabetics. My great-grandmother, grandfather, mother, and I are all diabetics. But they all got it somewhere in their 50s or in their 60s, and not necessarily through what I did, which was severe overeating. And by that I mean having McDonald's 5 days a week, you know, having Jell-O pudding pops, have, you know, excessive ice cream cake, binging on Sundays every weekend. So it was pretty clear to me that when I was, you know, officially diagnosed with diabetes and having the symptoms of thirst and frequent urination and tingling in the fingers and the blurry vision, that I pretty much knew what had been causing that.
Yeah, which tends to be the trend right now. We're seeing people at a younger and younger age being diagnosed with type 2, which normally would have been in the 50s. And I think it's obviously because of exactly what you're talking about, lifestyle, diet, and loads of stress added on top of that.
Absolutely. As of the year 2000, one-third of all children born after the year 2000 in America will become type 2 diabetic.
I know, which is...
A third of them are obese, and, you know, our genes have not changed, so our genetic predisposition to get this disease has not changed in the last 100 years, but what has? How much we eat, what we eat, and how much we move, or lack thereof.
Exactly. So, you know, yourself, like me, I had it in the family as well, a heredity factor, but I personally... I never thought it would happen to me.
You never do.
Yeah. Did you?
No.
Exactly. Okay.
No, not at all. I heard these stories of my grandfather having to take these shots, and of, great grandmother having strokes and she had a wooden leg. And it seems so foreign to me. I had never met these people. They were dead from this disease before I was ever born. And I never expected in a million years that I would be one of the ones who had it.
Wow. Yeah. So what was your initial reaction?
Complete shock. You know, I was in a very nice restaurant, the Franciscan in San Francisco near Pier 39. A couple of people know that. I was with a friend who was a type 2 diabetic, and she had recognized not only my classic symptoms, which I had already mentioned, but my classic eating behavior of what a lot of type 2 diabetics are, which is this emotional eater who overeats and doesn't move a lot. And she waited for me to finish my, you know, four-course meal of filet mignon and mashed potatoes and Irish cream liqueur and truffles for dessert. And then she checked my blood sugar, and it was something like 240. It was a very high number. It was like 220. It was in the twos. It was high enough.
Uh-huh.
And she just said, okay. And, you know, with that one word, it was like, you know, this is you. That, you know, this is what your problem is. And I got that checked out by the doctor and verified the very next day, and he said, yes, you know, you are, in fact, one of the youngest cases of what seems to be type 2 diabetes that I've ever seen.
So what did you use, or what tools do you have to manage that emotional content? Both, you know, you were also overweight, you said. So did you put, like, a whole program together to deal with both the physical, the mental, the emotional, and eating itself as well?
Well, you know, looking back, that is, I did go through that course. You know, I did develop that course for myself, and of course, that's what I put in my book, which, you know, it's just coming out that I'm trying to teach other people, which is, you know, you have all these elements to you that have caused you to develop this diabetes. You've gained weight, but why? You've stopped moving. Now, why have you done that? Why are you practicing this habit of eating the wrong foods over and over again. And of course, it's a lot more piecemeal the way that I went about it. I was, you know, I made a lot of mistakes along the way. But in terms of what I did and what I researched, I learned that, basically emotional eating, which is, I'm just going to define as just eating food, you know, just for the pure pleasure of it, whether or not it's your brain or your body that's motivating you to do that. But I learned that being a diabetic will predispose you to having a greater problem with that. You know, your blood sugar swings, you have problems with hormones like leptin, which regulates your metabolism, and it can also affect your cravings. You have certain neurotransmitters in your brain that are causing you to crave carbohydrates more if you have this condition. But also the very foods that you are eating can make you want to eat those foods more.
Sure.
And so if you break that cycle and you start eating the right foods, you'll stop craving the wrong ones.
Yeah. And what did you do as far as, what did you do to lose all the weight outside of just diet? I think you mentioned that you work out with resistance, weight training.
Yeah, I actually became certified as a trainer. I learned how, so I could just learn the science of exercise and what it was that I was going to need. So I developed a cardiovascular program for myself. I developed a weight training program for myself. I went on what I call a cyclic carbohydrate diet, which is basically a low carbohydrate diet for 5 to 7 days at a time, followed by 2 days of eating very clean carbohydrates. And admittedly, you know, on Thanksgiving, not so clean carbohydrates. But again, that's, you know,
it's
one or 2 days out of the year as opposed to once a weekend.
Yeah. Well, my mantra on that is as long as you keep the day in a holiday, you're going to be okay.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, nobody ever got fat in a day.
Exactly. Yeah.
Nobody ever got fat in a day.
Okay. Well, so physically, you've got that down. Like I say, I find in my travels and my clients, it's the same way. It's easy for me to get somebody to exercise. Perhaps even to do some stress reduction kind of things. It still comes down, the hardest part is down to dealing with, and I love the fact that you talk about the emotional part of this. It's the emotional part of eating. And that's why, I tend to put together a synergistic kind of flow to connect people more with what's going on within the body and to slow down and really listen to the body rather than to the brain or the cravings. I mean, what I'm trying to get at here, I'm trying to sort of pick it for exactly what you do to deal with the emotional content. Do you meet with people one-on-one? Do you have them journal? Do you have various exercises or meditations? How is it that you help get that part in check for them?
Well, I do a few things. The first thing that I do is I make them find the reason that it is so important for them to lose this weight and control their blood sugar. Is what is the intrinsic motivation for you so that feels better than chocolate cake will ever taste? And I make them really dig down deep and understand what that is. What is it that's going to bring you back from the dessert line again and again and again? The second thing that I do is I do prescribe them a diet that is more based on whole foods, a lot of lean meats, a lot of fish. We do use fish oil because, you know, the omega-3s in fish oil have been shown to increase insulin sensitivity and help with blood pressure, blood cholesterol, but also that can help with cravings.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that they're getting what they're eating, you know, 5 to 6 times a day, every 2 to 3 hours, everything that we can possibly do nutritionally just to help them with the quote-unquote emotional eating. And then we actually, you know, dig into, okay, what's going to keep you doing this and what's going to keep you from cheating on it? And that's where we start getting into the behaviors, the stress, and the emotional aspect. Now, in terms of journaling, yeah, we'll have them write down everything that they eat in a day and in particular, what they're craving and when.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that allows me to do is, for example, let's say that I've got an office worker, and like a lot of office workers, they're going to start craving carbohydrates around 10 a.m. and around 2 p.m., or, you know, for everybody's times are different for that, but let's just say mid-morning and mid-afternoon. Now, hormonally, there's some stuff going on with your cortisone levels at those times that, when coupled with a lack of sleep and a lot of stress, are going to trigger more carbohydrate cravings at those times than any other time in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that you can do is you can really start pointing out to them, okay, now notice this. You started wanting the pastries and the candy bar at this time, and notice that you got too few hours of sleep the night before. You know, notice what happened with your boss a little earlier in the day. And so you can start really helping them to piece together their own behaviors that are causing some of those cravings. Now, that's more behavioral. And then we also just look into the emotions. You know, what is it? Okay, you're just craving ice cream for the sake of craving ice cream, and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Let's talk about that. And, you know, you can start doing some digging in, and, you know, there's a questionnaire that I have in the back of my book that actually takes the reader through this. Okay, this is what you're craving. You know, how do you feel about it? You know, what do you think about it? You know, and go through these action steps that actually kind of just helps them take that apart. And by the end of it, one of the great things is if you're doing that, you're delaying it enough to the point that you're just not even going to want the ice cream.
Exactly, exactly. Because you've gotten past that point. I love the fact that you mentioned sleep, because not very often is that brought up. And it's really huge as far as not just in diabetes, but just with health in general, and also stress levels. And as you know, stress levels are driving sugars up. And here we go.
Yep.
So good for you. Now, you'd mentioned also about the type of diet you're on. You know, so many days, a low carb. What is the low carb range for you? I mean, do you have your clients on a specific range of carbs?
You know, for a lot of people, a low carb diet, and I do follow this adage, a low carb diet is going to be less than about 30 grams of carbohydrates per day.
Okay.
And, you know, that's not completely written in stone, but I prefer 20 to 40, and I prefer that for a few reasons. One, the carbohydrates are going to be low enough that I know that you're not going to have these extra spikes in blood sugar and insulin that are going to keep you out of that fat loss zone that is so important for type 2 diabetics, because they're statistically have the hardest time losing weight of any population.
Sure.
You know, except for maybe somebody with Cushing's disease, but that's a different story. You know, but two, the carbohydrates there are low enough that you're not going to get a little mini cheat in. It's not like, okay, I'm just going to eat meat and then a candy bar.
Yeah.
You know, I know that trick.
Yeah, exactly.
Aaron Snyder there, author of The New Diabetes Prescription. But before we go, a few words of advice from registered dietitian Elizabeth DeRobertis.
Okay, so the first thing is to make sure that you're looking at carbohydrates on a food label and not sugar. So carbohydrates and serving size to figure out which foods have less carbohydrates per serving. The second thing would be to really focus on spacing out your carbohydrates during the day so that you don't end up accumulating too many carbohydrates in one sitting. And a very general number would be that a meal should have somewhere between 30 and 60 carbs, and a snack somewhere between 15 and 20 carbs. But the third bullet, which I think is probably the most important, is to get a meter. They don't cost anything. You know, most offices would give someone a meter for free. And test your blood sugar 2 hours after your meal. 2 hours after a meal, blood sugar should be 140 or less. When you wake up in the morning, your blood sugar should be 110 or less. Figure out what your individual tolerance is to carbohydrates. How many carbs can your body handle and end up with a blood sugar of 140 or less 2 hours later? If someone can do those three steps, they will immediately have so much more information to work with.
My thanks to my guest, Aaron Snyder, author of The New Diabetes Prescription and nutrition coach. You can find him at thenewdiabetesprescription.com. And Elizabeth DeRobertis, she's a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator. More details are available at nutritionistliz.com. You can find out more about diabetes health alternatives by going to diabeteshealthalternatives.com, joining us on Facebook, or you can find us on iTunes. We'll have more next week. For now, this is Diabetes Health Alternatives. I'm Bradley Capture. Remember to choose health.
Diabetes Health Alternatives is produced by Jane Hannah Media.